Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks to you who are joining me live for the Heretics Hour tonight. I'm Carolyn Yeager, and the date is September 8, 2014. My topic tonight is presented as a choice, yet I've come to understand that this choice will never be made with any finality, because people will always sort themselves out on both sides of the question. But the title of the show is the choice between fatherlands or white nationalism, posed as a question. Now, I had a hard time naming this program. I finally had to do some, put something down. And I'm not, it's the best I could do, I think, because it's not an easy program to actually do, and it's not an easy subject to talk about, and it doesn't lend itself to anything smooth and pleasant. So, but it's a burning question, seems to be. It burns inside of me, and every so often I still, I have to do something about it. I think, well, I'll do a program on it. This is actually related to a couple other programs I've done, which I'll mention in a minute. But let me just say here that, I was going to talk about, but I think I'm going to wait until the end of the show, and if I have time, I'll do it, which I probably will. So rather than start out with it, because it seems a little bit too much to start out with, so I'll save that for later. I'm not saying that to keep people listening, but really just because I don't think it's quite right, since it's not part of the topic of the program, to start out with it. So I'll continue on here by saying, but this title that I have is still not the number one question being asked and discussed today. No, I'm saying that it is. It is. Excuse me. I've written this for myself in a funny way with a not in there, so I've got confusing myself. In a way, it's the number one question being asked and discussed today. Which is, how does a racially conscious person, and I'm really speaking only to racially conscious persons tonight, they're the only ones who would care about it, what's being said, and being a minority, we're certainly not going to change whatever this decision would be, if there would be an answer to this question, it's not going to change the world, because it's only still a small number who would be putting it into operation, so to speak. So, but how do we racially conscious people organize ourselves in the world today? White nationalists clearly vote for unity, but the question remains: who is included in this white nation? When the choice is between white and black, it's easy to include everyone with white-looking skin. But when it is organizing and running the white nation itself, we find the devil is in the details. And I'm going to point out some of those devils in this program. To be fair, white nationalists say that national allegiance is a positive, proper thing, and there's no problem with it. You know, you can be a white nationalist and remain a nationalist for your own individual nationality, shall I say. If you have a country in the world today that's the homeland for your nationality, you naturally would be partial to that and be interested in that and helping that, but it doesn't stop you from being a white nationalist. But in actuality, I think uh, most people think, and most people, it ends up coming down to the fact that it conflicts with putting race first, by which, of course, they mean the white race. So there are examples, you know, where if you would in any way not stand up for all white people, then, you know, you're not being a good white nationalist. For example, on my website, carolynyeager.net, all I did was the other day was write a post proving that Adolf Hitler did not have dark hair, as some people were saying on another website, and I hear it often enough, people saying that, but that he had medium brown hair. And then someone calling himself Sam wrote a comment to that post and said, the question you should be asking yourself, Carolyn, is why give a damn whether his hair was brown or dark brown? Who cares if he had mongrel genes in him? It doesn't change his message at all. So please quit with all the Slav and Med bashing. They are all our racial brethren. Well, I replied, but what I didn't put in my reply, until I maybe in a second one later on, but is that saying he has dark hair doesn't mean he had mongrel genes. And does this person even know what mongrel is? Mongrel is mixed race. So that doesn't. But he says it doesn't change his message at all, as though it doesn't matter what the man, it doesn't matter if he were Mediterranean, if he were Slavic, if he were not fully German, if he were this, that, or the other thing. It doesn't matter, because the only thing that matters is his message. Well, you encompass your message. You can't give a message that you are in your own person, not fitting into, you know, not embodying or personifying. So he's wrong there too. But anyway, I replied that insisting on the truth of brown hair, which is simply the truth about Adolf Hitler, was not Slav or Med bashing. And should have added, but saying Hitler had dark hair, I should have added, but I didn't. Saying Hitler had dark hair was Hitler bashing, because it was Hitler lying, but and not caring about lying, past saying things that you happen to think. Because this post also addressed that the same person, not this Sam, but the same person had included Himmler in that, having dark hair, and Himmler's hair was more even lighter than Hitler's for sure. So, you know, people get these things wrong, and they get angry if you correct them. You know, they don't want to be corrected. They want to say whatever they feel like. So beyond that, you know, he's insisting that then all whites are racial brethren, and therefore, you know, you can't be disagreed with or called to account for anything, or you're attacking your racial brethren. So this is the kind of problems one gets into, which I find they stand out to me, and I think, you know, this shouldn't be allowed without comment and without calling these people on what they're doing. So I've got first in this subject, on this subject matter, is how to define white. For any organized entity to succeed and hold together, terms must be clearly defined. White is a color, as in white, black, yellow, and red. So it distinguishes white people from black people, yellow people, red people. Maybe you could say brown people. It doesn't say anything about blood, culture, intelligence, geography, or language. Those are just the ones I thought up, you know, that aren't included in that. There might be a few more. As I brought out in a past program, and here's where I'm going to mention these other programs, particularly this one, which I did on Saturday, April 4th of this year, so 6 months ago, which I titled White Nationalism, Eurasianism, and the Future of Europe, which is the one that the very program that caused Tanstaffel to shut down the entire white network in order to disassociate himself from me forever. Though I consider that program one of the best I have done. For Mr. Tanstaffel, however, questioning white nationalism was verboten in his limited experience, in which white nationalism was the highest good he had yet discovered. But I want to connect that program, which you can find under the archives for Saturday afternoon on at carolynyeager.net, with today's program, and you know, 6 months later, where I first started looking at this situation and had the courage, I would say, to speak about it, and as I said, just told you what the results of that was. But I also feel that it is connected with the program I did just on Saturday, this past Saturday, titled The Deeper Meaning of Nuremberg, which arouses my nationalist feelings. That's why. And then some things I did a guest spot with at Red Ice Radio with Lana Lochteff, and after I finished that, which was actually August 29th, it was recorded, I felt there were things, I'd like to say more, I'd like to say this and that. It was along the lines of what I'm going to be saying tonight. So that also played a part somehow in like, well, I didn't go far enough here. This was stayed kind of tame, but it just stirred up some things in me. Maybe however it was that that show went, it just stirred up some things that then I wanted to say more things. So these two shows, Saturday's show and that one back on April 15th, didn't I say it was? Anyway, April 4th, I'm sorry, April 4th, have played a part in developing my movement in this direction, you might say, my personal movement in this direction. So the question comes up, the question comes up in my mind that I think some people listening to me might be asking and probably have perhaps been asking lately, why don't I have a guest on to discuss this? Why am I just talking about it by myself? Well, my answer is that I don't know of anyone who will say what I want to say. So I want to get certain things across on my programs. And if somebody, if there was somebody who would think just like I do and say these things, I'd really be anxious to have them on. Plus, when you have a guest, the show is supposed to be about your guest. And as I just intimated, I don't want any longer to give away my forum to someone with divergent views or that I'm not getting my own views out that have gotten, I suppose, stronger and more clear to me than they used to be. So those days are over for me, really. The days of being an interviewer and just trying to get interesting guests on. Now, so, that's why I have invited people to call in tonight. And I do that I'm very sincere about that. It's for the purpose of allowing other people's views to come out on this, but not to have one person for the whole show who will, take over the show but to allow some other points of view, which I don't mind hearing at all, and I wouldn't mind having some back and forth on it. So, and I don't have to treat a caller, you see, the way I would have to treat an invited guest. So if I don't like what the caller is saying, or if they go on too long, I can hang up. But I will try to be, I do try to be polite to my callers. So if that is the reason I put that in the post, and the phone number here is 323-642-1206. And I also added to my program post, which you'll find on my website. I didn't put it on Blog Talk. I just had time before the show to add a link to a map I'm going to be talking about. But that's the last thing I'm going to be talking about, and that's the IQ map of Europe. But I'll remind you again when I get to that. But there is a link on the program post for this program at my website now, which was just added before the show started. So to continue, now categorizing the devils that are in the details of this question and this sensitive issue. Before I discuss any more, this first one, I'll give the second and the third one, and then I'll go into in more detail. So the second is, in my estimation, and believe me, this isn't the last word in this, I'm sure. I just had to come up with, I had to organize this in a very short time, really, as to how I was going to present this tonight. I did it today, and my mind. Some days I have trouble waking up. It's like I just feel sluggish until like 4 o'clock in the afternoon or so, and then finally I wake up. So, but what I've done the best I could with this. And it's not perfect, but the second devil, so to speak, is how important are the racial classifications within what's called white? They are ethnies, which the racial classifications within white are ethnies which have been called races and can still be found geographically in Europe. As I came up with it, not probably the best language used here, but the Latin race, the Anglo race, the Germanic race, the Scandinavian race, the Slavic race, which you can call sub-races or you can call them whatever you want, but they are something that's recognized and distinct. And then there is the Finnish Estonian, which is some distance away from the Hungarian, but somehow sort of, in a way, they're related. And that takes up as many of them as I can identify. So these are considered, even though they may object, the people who are part of these races may object. They're considered, it's not very important to white nationalists, even though white nationalists may object to my saying that. They say that it's important to them, but it can all be sorted out later, and it should not be allowed to cause divisions to white unity. So first we start with white unity, and then if we have any... anything about the different groupings and classifications of white, well, we can worry about that later after we've gained a victory under the white banner. And this brings up the European Union policies and the way the European Union is run. And I think that things like this always go this way. That's why I compare it to the European Union, because I know they don't want to be compared to that, because European Union is not racially motivated in the least. It's anti-race and so on. But still, the European Union started out saying, well, you know, we're going to accord every nation that's part of our union full freedoms and sovereignty and rights, and nothing is going to change for you, but we're just going to join this body that gives us more strength together. You know, we work together, and then we have to have a head for it. We have to have a headquarters and so on. And that turned out to be Brussels, Belgium, which is probably the most bureaucratic place and the least national history, because Belgium was actually part of the Netherlands and part of France, which for some reason, I really don't know the history of it, but they called it Belgium. And it's got a little part of Germany too in it, and but very small. And they speak, but the thing is, they speak their own languages. In the northern part of Belgium, they speak Dutch. In the southern part, they speak French. And in that little part there, they speak German. And that's all okay. They don't have a single language. So it's a very prototype of, you know, the kind of colorless, you know, colorless, passionless kind of a Europe. And then as time goes on, and this story is so well known, I don't want to go on about it, but, you know, they get more and more dictatorial because take away more of the sovereignty of the individual nations because they they need to have a single voice. And they need to expand, and they had to expand into currency, into the euro. I hope I don't forget later on if that's the place it would fit in. Maybe it fits in right here. That Greece, I'll just stick this in here. Greece was allowed to. I should go into this when I get into the where I say I'm going to fill it out more. So let me move on. Okay. But is there anything inherent, okay, I was talking about these racial classifications. Is there anything inherent in these racial classifications that can or would cause major disharmony, I ask? I haven't answered that yet. So I'm going to go on to I did one and I did two, and now go on to three. How important are the intelligence levels of the white racial groups? Is it okay to discuss that? Because that's always sensitive, you know. As soon as you bring up intelligence, wow. You know, people stay away from that. Will political correctness put a lid on this and forbid us to even notice it, as cultural Marxism does in the larger society? And along with the intelligence levels is the achievement and leadership ability. That goes hand in hand with it. So there we have some potential problems with uniting what are actually disparate people. When we look at each of these devils more closely, we see the complexity. So first, let me say that while I will, if given a choice and sight unseen, pick any white person to live amongst me over any non-white person, that would not always turn out to be the best choice for my safety and well-being. Still, I would do it because I'm committed to the race idea. And I believe that culturally speaking, I could communicate and reason with that person more effectively, that is, a white person, than a non-white person. But I could be in for some bad surprises, and I know I would be, because that often is just not, doesn't follow along those lines in that way. But I could be in for some bad surprises by thinking that this white person is more like me than he actually is, just because he's white. And I might be expecting more understanding than I will get from this white person. And I might run into intra-white hatreds that I'm not prepared for would come back at me from this white person. So, and these are all mostly cultural things. But you can find, of course, many non-white people who are quite easy to get along with and would be probably good, very good neighbors and all of that. So I'm aware of that. And being white doesn't make people better. It actually doesn't. Although on the whole, white people are, and are, in a white person's estimation anyway, well, according to our value systems, are better. They're better for us, but in many cases, there's many exceptions to this rule. So that's about all I can. Okay, I'll go into now into that Greek thing. I'll fit that in here, and the European Union and the euro. Now, when they decided to come up with their own currency and the eurozone, you know, it was a small group of the Western European nations that participated, and Greece wanted to get in on it for whatever reason. I don't know. The Jews, in the form of Goldman Sachs, helped Greece to do that. It could have been part of a Jewish plot or whatever, desire to cause a weakness in the European Union and any other kind of thing along those lines. But Greece was really not prepared to become a part of the Eurozone at all, but they wanted to very badly for some reason. You'd have to ask those people what that reason was. But they did get help from Goldman Sachs, at least, and that's in the, then bankers, I guess, that they're associated with, the banking community. And there were people, and I know in particular Germans that I had read about that said that Greece didn't belong in this particular group, and they would never get in. And they said to this Greek representative, I think he was a Greek prime minister or something, you'll never get in here because you don't belong in this. And they didn't belong, but they got in. And they've caused trouble. It's been trouble after they spent all the money and used up all the money that they got in low interest loans and so on. And then they got in big trouble, and they're still in big trouble and trying to get out of it, and they blame, of course, the very people who helped them get in, helped them get what they wanted, in which they didn't belong. So that is one example where this kind of giving a blind eye to differences that do actually exist, because it seems like you're being prejudicial or something. Does harm in the long run. Now, people could say there's all kinds of things going on in that they can come up with, but I haven't come across any of that somehow there are all kinds of other shenanigans. I think it's basically that Greece had this real hard on to get into that, to, you know, to show that they were good enough or something. That's how it has turned out. And so now going on to the second devil, that is the ethnies, or the ethnic groups, also can be called national groups, which is the best way to put it in my estimation. And for nationalists, this is very important. as Bardesh, Maurice Bardesh, who I featured on the program on this past Saturday. As he made the case in his revisionist book, that originally nationalism is connected to the land of your ancestors, which has been passed down to you. The fatherland is the strongest pull there. There is. The fatherland is the strongest pull there is, and men have gone to battle for it over and over again throughout history. It is definitely something to die for. It stirs the blood for those who can relate to it. And I believe that absolutely, and I think it's a proven fact that those who really do relate to the land of their fathers have something, some connection and love for this and willingness to defend it, that other people who don't have this connection don't understand, and just they might be able to understand it somewhat, but they don't feel it themselves. So, and those who can't feel this or relate to this are those without a fatherland. And why don't they have a fatherland? Because of mixed heritage. That's why. And that's where Americans come in, and American white nationalism comes in, because of the well-known, often praised, highly praised, mixed European heritage of Americans. And plenty of whites in America have three or four grandparents from three or four different ethnic groups. And these, what is their fatherland? They don't have one. They can't, they've got several. So that it becomes all of Europe. And these are the ones who generally mostly see the United States or Canada as their homeland. And white nationalism is what works for them. Because any other kind of nationalism doesn't work for them, you see. So this is one of the distinctions between the two camps that might be found, although it probably doesn't hold, I know it doesn't hold across the board at all. There's just all kinds of exceptions here, but still in all, there is a fact that if you have, if you come from, let's say, even two, you've got to pick between one or the other, and then when you have three or four, or even five, because they're split, you know, half and half and so on, well, then you don't, where do you belong? You belong to Europe. You belong to the white race, and that's what you're comfortable with. But being born in the United States, or the USA, doesn't make for the same sense of fatherland that you would be willing to die for, especially when you have strong or clear-cut ethnic roots in a particular part of Europe. Now, there are people who are willing to die for the USA, who feel very strong patriotism and so on. And there are white families whose family roots in the New World here go back. You can only go back so far, but if you go back to the 1600s, you're doing really good, you know, and you might feel really connected to this land, particularly if your family has lived on in a particular place or owned a piece of land for for a couple of centuries. But that's unusual. I mean, there are those. They're usually people in the elite by now, but they're most Americans don't relate to that. Don't have that kind of experience. So, for non-whites in the United States, they'd have their roots in other places also. So being a United States citizen becomes more like a business agreement or, you know, an economic venture than it is a fatherland. That's what I think. And that's why so many Americans still relate to their European ancestral home when it comes to identity and identifying themselves. So at the same time going on here, white nationalism is also a kind of intellectual exercise. You know it's right. You know it's good. You know it's necessary to be, to think racially along and support the white race, but it doesn't stir your blood. And I think this is true. This is the real part of it here, because what stirs your blood is not just words, but in white nationalism, feel very strongly about it, but it's not the same. And particularly if you've had a regime in your fatherland that left any marks of glory, if you can relate to things that are of a very stirring nature for yourself and that give you great pride and so on, and if you know some part that maybe your ancestors played there, this has a lot of power. And this is the kind of power we need to move things along, to make ourselves felt. This is what's necessary, and we don't have that here in the United States or in other places where it's just about race. It sounds good, but people don't act on it in the same way and don't defend it in the same way. So just for an example, France's National Front and its leader, Marine Le Pen, it's a party that's anti-immigrant and anti-EU, you know, good. It won the latest European Union elections for France and claimed nearly 25% of the votes, won the election, and she is now ahead in the polls for becoming the prime minister in the upcoming elections in France. And she says her message has kind of evolved over time. She's gotten bolder. And the last thing she said is, our people demand one type of politics. They want politics by the French, for the French, with the French. They don't want to be led anymore from outside to submit to laws. But she's been criticized for not being a white nationalist and being too friendly with this or that group. She's very anti-Muslim, but not outwardly anti-Jewish. But she has been able to build up a following of people who trust her there in France and get to where she's going to win an election. However, they have these rounds in Europe. So you win round one because there's a lot of parties running, and you get the most, but you don't have a majority. Then you have to run again against the next one or two runners up to you, and then people can realign themselves. And you can very easily not win, you lose. So it's not a sure thing. But anyway, she has come a long way, and she's doing it on being French, wanting France to stay French, not talking about whites, France being white. Because for one thing, the French is is a nation in Europe that is probably the Western Europe of the major nations most mixed, except for like Southern Italy. France has really been mixed with non-white blood, but it still looks white and still pretty much acts white, and so it's considered white, and we're happy for it to be doing well and stand for it, but it's not what it once was. It's already what you might say, you know, contaminated, and their IQ score shows it, which we'll get to later. Now, a little bit more about France, President François Hollande, his popularity in France, and he's a regular, you know, EU liberal socialist. His popularity has hit a record low, just over 13%. So while Marine Le Pen, who is pro-France, is for the French, is riding high right now. So ethnic loyalties bring up a discussion of race loyalties in the form of homelands. And I'm going to turn now to Germany, and I have to talk about National Socialist Germany because present-day Germans are under the control of the New World Order and a leading voice in the European Union and so on, and that's where that is. We can't get, but still we can say that Germans still want Germany to be for Germans. And under National Socialism, Germans taught that German blood was the number one good, and to defile that was something like a sin. And that worked, you know. And I've been reposting from Hanning Scott's National Socialist Worldview blog site a booklet written by Professor Rudolf Frerichs. And I'd like to go into that a little bit here. First, I was going to mention some of this on Saturday, and I skipped past it because I didn't have time, and now I have more information. Hanning has posted part 10 of this booklet and the final part of this booklet written by Professor Frerichs. So I'm going to read that because it sheds light on what I'm talking about here. So I think it's worthwhile. The first two quotes I'm going to give here is from what has already been posted even on my own site that I reposted from his site. And then the last part is the new part. And if a French leader in power today, if say Le Pen called for something like this, or if she got into power, let's say if Le Pen was elected prime minister, and if she established some departments like this that put out material like this, it would carry real weight because it would come from a real country. See, and that's what's missing with white nationalism. No matter what gets put out, there's no geographic home to it, and there's no power base to it. You know, France has nuclear weapons, even if I'm right about that. I mean, France is, for all its failings, is still a powerful country in the world. And so, if you could get something like this going there, we would really get somewhere. Anyway, this first quote is from Frerichs that I thought was meaningful. It says, when the new purpose was called humanity and mankind, nothing stood in the way of mixing. What he was referring to there is that when the language, he's talking about probably the Weimar period after World War I, when they started talking about humanity and mankind, those words, you know, that were brought up by Maurice Bardèche that I talked about on Saturday. He says, nothing stood in the way of mixing. That is race mixing. When you start talking like that, humanity and mankind and so on, race mixing is going to happen. That's all there is to it. And in a sense only, white nationalism, by being so broad amongst all white people, and saying we're all one in a sense. We're all the same. We're all equal. Then nothing stands in the way of mixing amongst whites. And most white people, most white nationalists, cannot bring themselves to say that they don't, that there's anything wrong with any kind of intermarriage and interbreeding amongst white people of any nationality in any way and type. And this is absolutely not considered the case in National Socialist Germany. And in, when they say mixing, they mean mixing with other Europeans, because there was no mixing with Negroes or Arabs or things like that at that time. They're talking about mixing German blood with other European bloods, and so which they thought was not a good idea. So this is a big, big difference. And what they mean by that, and the way it is in the European Union, is, you know, let us come into your land, let our children learn your language, and let them marry your children. And this is the way of thinking of many Slavs in relation to Western European. Now, I know not all, but many, many feel that they're disenfranchised, they're powerless, they're poor, particularly down in the Balkans, and they say, well, now, you know, they want to get into the European Union, and then they'll be able to move around. And basically the idea is, in the name of humanity, it's your duty to help us. But whenever they feel that they have the power over others, these particular national groups, they are ruthless. They're without pity. They're killers. But they play a different, they sing a different tune when they're looking to be helped. And this is a big part of what's going on and what we're all against. It's not just the blacks coming in. It's not just the Turks and the other non-whites coming in. It's these supposed whites, and we'll get into that a little bit more later as to how white they are. In the Jewish question, which was most palpable among us, okay, now, this is Frerichs again, the second quote. In the Jewish question, which was most palpable among us, an entire generation, by which I think he means the Weimar generation, that's what I would put there, that had learned to see only the human in the human, not the Jew or even the Slav, according to the Germans at that time, that those this was... in the Weimar period, well, and this was also relates to what the way Bardesh wrote about the Nuremberg Tribunal, the human person, and Frerichs is saying we were taught then, they tried to teach us, the Germans, that when we looked at people, we should see only the human in the human. We don't see a nationality, we don't see a race, we don't see these kinds of things. That would be wrong. So, and then he writes, the entire handling of the Jewish problem in the years prior to the seizure of power should be viewed essentially in terms of the political education of the German people, whose racial instincts had been to a dangerous degree lost. So he says, in the beginning of the Adolf Hitler regime, it was essentially a process going on in educating the German people during the 30s, say, to bring back their racial instincts, which they had lost, which is therefore was considered extremely important. So now, and again, they weren't needing to be to protect themselves from Africans or, Chinese or anything like that, were they? No. Mostly they're talking about Jews. Mostly Jews is what's implied, but there are also others. Now, now I'm going to quote from the final installment just posted by Hadding. And I want to say that he's learned that Dr. or Professor Frerichs, who previously has been identified as his book, this booklet and other works of his were approved by the NSDAP Office of Racial Policy. Well, now he's found that Frerichs is the vice director, was the vice director of this Office of Racial Policy under Walter Gross. So it wasn't just that his book was approved. He's actually the second man in charge there. And he writes, this one is titled, Our Mission in Racial Policy. And this is, as I said, the ending of the booklet. So this is the final part of it. And subheading, National Socialism is Applied Racial Doctrine. National Socialism is Applied Racial Doctrine. So it goes, National Socialism has recognized that the destiny of all peoples is bound not to external accidents, to lost wars, to an undermined economy, or to a natural disaster, but that a nation's will to live solely and exclusively determines whether the race and the type, and therewith all the achievements of political, cultural, and economic life produced by it, are maintained through the centuries of history. We know, therefore, that all external measures in the end would be futile, that all exertions and casualties of the struggle, all commitment for building anew would be in vain. If in a few hundred years, persons with different faces would then inhabit German lands, who, although they might still speak our language, would think and feel differently because they would be of an alien blood. And this certainly means that the alien blood is anybody that's not German. That's what it means. Whenever the question of healthy and valuable progeny in a people is no longer regulated by natural instinct and ethnic status, in quotes, has been overcome, it is the duty of a state recognizing the biological laws of racial and populational policy as the foundation of its existence to intervene. The duty of the state to intervene to keep the racial and populational racial foundation of the state intact. To liberal thinking, such measures may seem harsh, but they are nonetheless salubrious for the people as a whole. Therefore, the new state had to undertake first, through the law for the prevention of congenitally ill progeny, to cause the unhealthy hereditary lines of our people to run dry and to exclude them from propagation. And beyond that, to prevent mixture with racial aliens. Even more important than these measures for protection against the congenitally incompetent and different are the positive measures that add up to a promotion of families that are congenitally healthy and rich in children. The state seeks to facilitate the founding of families through marriage loans, tax breaks, and compensation funds. We must keep in mind, however, that these practical measures, necessary and desirable in themselves, will gradually yield what is required for keeping a people alive. That is because the new state's challenges in populational policy require the voluntary commitment of the will of every individual. A new heading of the next section, Education About Racial Policy. Our racial world of beholding and experiencing is so basic and instinctual that we consider it fundamentally mistaken only to use promulgation of heredity laws and many isolated scientific facts to move Germans to a changed attitude toward the child and toward the biological occurrence of the folk. For 2,000 years, the German people has taken the path of self-preservation and growth of its substance as a people without having known anything about the laws of heredity. And we are convinced that also in the future, it will not, that is, the German people will not consider this necessary for its racial health if it succeeds in clearing away from the soul of the German person all the rubbish and refuse of a merely calculating and mechanically oriented epic. Our mission, deriving from biological facts, must be again to lead the nation as a whole into rediscovering the path to itself and heeding the voice of its own blood, and furthermore rejecting all the values adopted from outside as alien to its essence. With this inner orientation, the life of the people also will be secured in regard to its racial character. A quote here from Adolf Hitler. What was shackled for 1,000 years is being liberated for the salvation and for the health of our people and for others. The nobility of the human body has separated itself from its defilement and decay. A new world of beauty proclaims itself. Okay, the final section is the, no, not, this is not the final one, second to the last, the German woman as protectress of the type. And here it has been shown to the German woman where she can assist in the mission of racial rebuilding. Her cooperation is perhaps the most important, since whether we shall continue on the path of biological decay or whether respect and reverence for the eternal process of life will rise again in the next generation depends ultimately on her relationship to the child and to the family. The youth must again, with a sense of destiny, learn to understand that it is only a link in the chain of the eternal sequences of generations of a people, and it must eventually in turn be the beginning of new chains of generations if the people of the Germans want to live and ought not to shrink in number in the next decades. The education should not consist in conveying knowledge, rather we have a much broader concept of education in racial policy, and we mean by that the returning of the person in the depth of his soul, in his character. It is legitimate to overcome the false inner attitude of the person, which is not to be accomplished with the aid of calculation, clever words, or imparting of knowledge, but only and exclusively through an inner transformation of the person himself. Thus will the education of the youth into a natural, life-affirming life allow a healthy new generation to mature, for which the body is not bad in itself and must be chastened for the salvation of the soul. We wish, moreover, in accord with the words of our leader at the Stuttgart Gymnastic Festival, a youth, quote, with a radiant spirit and magnificent bodies, unquote. If it is rumored from groups of emigrants that we have turned to barbarism, they might call it that. If we again understand it to mean life in its original condition, bound to nature and close to the earth, the meaning and the purpose, however, ought to be, and only then will the work have succeeded, to make all work of enlightenment and education in racial policy superfluous when the life of the nation again cuts its path vigorously and instinctively into the future. Well, finally, we have the racial idea structures of the racial idea structures the German future. Today, the epic of raceless thinking is dissolved by the thought and the idea of human polymorphism, the value of which stems exclusively from rootedness in ancestry and soil, the historic mission of which consists in the representation of its own incontrovertible and eternal value. This breakthrough of new racial thinking must find its natural adversaries among all those who are anxious to produce the unity of the culture and of the social order and organization of mankind through calculation or even dogmatically through a religion. Quote, when we this is, I think this is, this entire quote is from Dr. Walter Gross, who is the head of the Office of Racial Policy. When we speak of race, we mean the whole to which body and physicality is necessary, which, however, also extends into that great sphere of the life of the mind and the soul. If we deliberately conduct a racial policy, we are not thereby cultivating men as if they were cattle. Rather, we are taking care that healthy men grow from whose healthy blood the great law of their kind speaks, and which now, for the first time in this world, can structure what the German people has sought and longed for and striven after on an endlessly long, bitter path through centuries of its history. And, you don't end there. Through centuries of its history, the dominion of the Germans, about which we believe that it is not only a state, but a dominion of the soul. Dr. Walter Gross. So he gets, they get really going here, you know. Race is, if people want to say, my race is my religion, a lot of people, that's a famous saying. My race is my religion. Well, there's something about that here, in that for the German National Socialists, the building up again of the German race was of the highest order and the highest nature. And it had to do not with just the body and the physicality, but with the soul. So you can't, the German soul is a very distinct thing. And it, you can't mix it up with other souls, even if they're white. That's kind of the message there. I would say, whoops, I just lost my place. So nationalists want to be more closely related, I would say, to their true racial brethren, not, that is of the same nationality, basically, the same country that they're from, the same land and ancestry, and don't want to give up the primacy of their historic homeland either, which in many cases a united Europe would do. There's no way to keep the two things. You can't keep the special sacredness of your own homeland boundaries, your land that you've been in for centuries, and then say, well, we're all going to be one Europe, and people are going to be coming and going freely. That's no other way to do it, you know, than that way. So the two things don't really go together. And those who, to me, foolishly say we can have or do both, and they do that, just like the European Union said, we can have both, but they can't do it, and the white nationalists wouldn't do it either. In the United States, it doesn't matter. In Europe, it does matter. Now, another point that I would make here, well, I already made this point. I wasn't sure if I had made it above, so I stuck it in down here. But once again, those of very mixed heritage can't really point to a fatherland. They might have a preference, and they could say, well, I picked this one, and that would be all right. But it's not quite, they're pulled in other directions too. This one Europe, for me, I don't know if I made a case on this. I've still got more further to go, but a one Europe doesn't work. First, who will lead? There can only be mediocre bureaucrats in charge, like with the EU, the UN, and so on. I mean, if you had a white nationalist Europe, if you had a united Europe of white nationalists, of racially conscious people, which is a far-fetched idea anyway, you know, but let's say, who would be the leader of it? It can't be any real strong national personality. It would have to be the more the bureaucratic type, you know, who can be objective about the whole thing and not show favoritism and not take sides. So then you have a passionless person, in a sense. People could argue that, that's for sure, argue against that. But I say that this is ideal for Jewish control, too, when you have something like this. When you have these big mixed groups, it's ideal for Jewish control because the Jews can always find somebody in there who's going to help them out, work with them. So let's now go on to the third devil, which is the intelligence variables among whites, which is for me the biggest obstacle to becoming true racial brethren amongst all white people. Again, I'll point out that the IQ map that I'm using, I have posted the link to it on the program announcement for this program at my website, carolynyeager.net, if you want to look at this map. And I picked this one out because I thought it was the best one. It's 2012. Let me go to it. It shows, let me see, what have I got? I'm not even checking. I don't have any callers. I haven't been looking. Haven't been looking, but it says zero callers. That means I haven't had any. Okay. I picked this map from other maps that I found, and I read a lot of articles on this, much of which I didn't find too helpful. But because this one is adjusted, it's based mainly on the Richard Lynn, the Lynn and Van Hanen, which you find almost everywhere as being what's used. And it's their 2012, so it's updated to be recent. And it's easy to look at and read and so on. So according to this, this is, and again, people can argue, and I sure am not an expert on IQ and any of this kind of thing, but I have been aware of it and following it for quite a number of years now. But I never could get into studying all the haplogroups and so on. So, but I don't think that's this. This just gives an overview, and it can't be that far off. It can be off somewhat, but it can't be that far off. So it shows definite highs and lows here that are probably, I would think, accurate. And so I'm going to start out by reading. I don't want to read this. Well, yeah, I have something here. Well, okay, these results are mostly from the 60-odd IQ data points Lynn and Van Hanen obtained from European countries and their overseas offshoots over the last half century. Well, that actually comes from an article in American Conservative, so I don't think I wanted to read that. I'm just going to talk about this map. As you can, if you're looking at it, you can see it, but guess what? The most intelligent people in Europe, as far as the results on their intelligence tests given to them, are the Finns. I don't think the Finns had quite as many tests given, so things could be off just a little bit. But if Lynn and Van Hanen thought this could be published and they stand behind this, then that means something. So Finland, 101 average IQ, and I think all these averages are shockingly low, really. They should be better, but they show, I think if they're accurate, they show the results of all the racial mixings and conflicts and so on that have taken place in Europe that have brought the IQ down, the IQ levels down. from what they should be. Like, you know, the high range should be like 107, 108 for the most intelligent. That, now, these are averages. You know, this is the average IQ. So you hit the average here, and then you got half the people there or above there, and the other half of the people there or below there. So realize that, but I still don't think that. I think that they should be higher, and I think they used to be higher probably. This is what we've got now from the result of all this race mixing going on. And then Estonia is 100. So those countries, Finland and Estonia, are highly related racially, and I guess you'd say genetically or something like that. And they're at the top. Other two countries at 100 are the Netherlands, that's the Dutch people, which are Germanic people, and Switzerland. Switzerland is mixed, but they have part of their country is Germanic, part is French, part is supposedly Italian. They speak different languages in Switzerland, too. Those are countries that have been left alone more, and have not been the recipients of so much immigration. And they show the benefits of that. And let's see. So then after that is the 99 number, Germany, Austria, Sweden, Britain, and Czech Republic. So that's interesting, and that, of course, I think Germany is down at 99 because of, all the emigration into Germany. And it's not as bad in Germany, I don't think it is, as in Britain. It's amazing Britain is even where it's at, if this is from 2012. I really don't know how, but they have a lot of Indians. Immigrants there, and the Indians are smarter than some of these other people. And maybe the Pakis are fairly intelligent too. So they haven't brought their IQ down so much. I don't know. I'm just talking from off my head here, thoughts that I have. But also, the Czech people are up there with Germany, Austria, Sweden, and Britain. And you know, when I was there, I thought they seemed pretty intelligent. I hold a lot against them, but they do run their country well, and they do things well, and they're certainly way ahead of Poland. I thought so, and they're way ahead of Poland in IQ here, too. So then we go, and poor old France is down at 98. That's not very good. See, that's the result of all that racial intermixture. Non-white intermixture into France, particularly in southern France. So, and then along with France is Hungary, Slovakia, Slovenia, and Croatia. Well, for those countries, I think those are pretty good numbers. And I know the Hungarians are intelligent people, so I'm not surprised at that. From what I've heard from people about the Slovaks and Slovenes, they are too, and I always did like the Croatians. And look at the Croatians are way up there, even though they're down there in the Balkans with all those lower IQs. There, they have a 98 in this study anyway. And then we go to 97, and this is about where you'd expect to find Russia, in my opinion. And that's where they're at, and along with Norway and Spain. Another thing, I was never under the impression that the Norwegians were particularly intelligent people. I don't mean that they're not, of course they're intelligent, but they're not the most intelligent. I'm not surprised to see them at 97. Then we go down. Now we're getting pretty far down now for your average for Europeans, and now we're down to 96. And we've got Italy, Poland, and Latvia under that. And, you know, the problem with Italy is that it's this long north-south country, extended length, and it's the southern part that I would say brings down the average IQ in Italy, because we know that there's a lot of African admixture in southern Italian, in southern Italy, and in Sicily. Look at the size of Sicily there, at the toe of the boot. It's a pretty big. Piece of land there. And then there's that other island out there, which I can't remember what it's called. Somebody would have to help me out there. I didn't look it up. I was going to. All right, I'm just... So now we get to 95, which is now you're getting low. And what do we have here? Ireland and Belarus. So I'm not surprised at Ireland either. I don't want to offend anybody. But overall, and of course, there's always the elites and so on are the better ones. But overall, the Irish are not all that intelligent. But as I read that the Irish in America are much more intelligent than the Irish in Ireland. And same with a couple other countries, whatever they were now, that the ones who went to the United States, they have much higher IQs. Quite a number of points. It makes a pretty big difference. And Ireland is on a level with Belarus, which they're not stupid, there you go. And then we get down to 94. Now I'd be embarrassed. I mean, I'm really embarrassed to have these scores for my country. And we've got Portugal and Lithuania and Ukraine. And we know that Portugal is very mixed with black, very black mixed, with African mixed. And I don't know what the problem with Lithuania is. Just being Lithuania, just being where they are, and Ukraine the same. Not so good. Then 93, we're getting down into the low rent district here, Bosnia, Herzegovina, Greece, and Bulgaria. So Greece does not do well, which is really not surprising, and Bulgaria either, which is above it and to the east. But then we go down to Moldova is 92, Romania and Macedonia are 91, and Serbia is 90. And, I'm sure Serbs will insist that that's not true. They do things like that, you know. They won't accept things they don't like about, that are said about themselves. But Serbia is just right above Turkey at 89. And then we go down to the two lowest ones, Montenegro, 86, and poor old Albania, 82. Wow, what's wrong with Albania? I've heard them called some bad things. And that's a country that's in total disrepair, I think. It's just they just don't have it. I don't know what's wrong with them, but something's wrong with them intellectually. And here's a story about Albania that is an example of what goes on there in that country. And it's just from 3 days ago. I just happened to see it while I was doing this. And the Albanian authorities, the title says, Albanian authorities arrest central bank governor. From the capital, Tirana, capital of Albania, Albanian central bank governor, Ardian Fulani, and a senior bank auditor were arrested Friday and charged with abuse of office for alleged mismanagement in connection with a multi-million dollar theft from the bank's reserves, prosecutors said. And a spokesman for the prosecutor's office said the Bank of Albania chief was taken into police custody following a court order late Friday. The arrest is linked to the alleged theft of 713 million lekes, which comes to 5 million euros, from a reserved storage building that was discovered in July. The money was allegedly stolen over the past 4 years, and Albanian authorities have already arrested 16 central bank employees in the case. A statement from the Prosecutor General's office said that the Bank of Albania Inspector General Elivar Golemi was also arrested Friday and faces the same charges. Wow, all these people running the banks, and then these people want to get into the European Union. And I didn't, I don't think Albania has been approved yet, but they want to be. And I think with somehow they're already allowed to go into Europe. This is crazy to let people like this join in to these unions. But going on here, if there's anything new here, one of the 16 employees previously arrested allegedly told authorities he spent his portion on casinos and betting. Well, he can't even, you know, doesn't even invest it in something good. He's just blows it. The fools. And Fulani was appointed governor in 2004, that is central bank governor, and he's serving his second 7-year term. So he's been in for 10 years, and he's busy stealing from the country. And this is an example of corruption. And we find that on the corruption map, which I actually have on the Blog Talk page, on my Blog Talk channel. But anyway, you can find corruption maps on, if you go to Google Images. But, you know, guess where the corruption is? It's in all these lower IQ countries. And the lower the IQ of the general IQ of the country, the more corruption there is. Everything goes by bribes and so on. It's not a pleasant way to live. These people can't manage their, they can't manage themselves. They end up being, it's just a place run by criminals. And Russia is one of the most corrupt nations in the world. It's really way up there. You know, Putin hasn't cleaned all that up. In fact, he's pretty corrupt himself. So this is, and the mistake that's made is that the European Union has included all these countries and is not all of them yet, but most of them. And then they're just bringing all that lack of ability and so on into mix in with the whole thing and weaken the whole thing. This is, but why do they do it? And why do white nationalists want to include as many people as possible, so many of them, as many white people as possible, to be strong, to be bigger? They think that size equals the strength that they'll have and the clout and so on. So they look the other way and say, oh, but these people are okay. They'll be all right. They fit us. They're the same as us. They're not the same. There's no, here you've got Germany with an IQ, average IQ, just in this study of 99. And then you've got Turkey at 89. And then you've got all these Turks going into Germany. And all they're doing is bringing down the IQ. That's probably why it's where it is now. They're bringing it down. And where does it go mostly? The children. They have a bunch of children. And that we know that in all our countries, and here in the U.S. too, everywhere, these invaders with their low IQs are filling up the schools with their children, and they're lowering the standards, and there's no way that you can avoid a certain amount of intermixing and interbreeding, intermarriage, It's destroying the race. It's destroying the white race. And I think that white nationalists are just as guilty in their unwillingness to criticize or find fault with or distance themselves from a lot of these so-called white countries as in the same way that the European Union is. I just already explained that, so I won't go over it again. I find this, I'm going to read here something about the decline of the average human IQ. This is written by a student, it appears, but he obviously was using everything he learned in his class on whatever the class is called, but it's about human IQ in his paper. So this is kind of ideas are now. It says, the larger the human population grows, the average human IQ seems to drop. Now, how is this possible? Studies show that since the 1950s, the average IQ has dropped a total of 3 points. This is alarming and confusing at the same time. How, with all our medical and technological advancements, is this occurring? Many charts that I have found showed that the average IQ was at its peak in 1950. That was 60 years ago. So again, 1950, you know, I was a school kid in 1950, and it's good to know that I always did think people are getting less intelligent, even in spite of, like you say, all their ability to function on, digital media and so on, doesn't mean that they're smarter. Not at all. So, we were smarter 60 years ago, and many blame this fall of global IQ on the fall of the Soviet Union. Well, I wouldn't. Now they go into all this stuff. In the Soviet Union's control of Eastern Europe, their children were forced to be schooled in far more advanced subjects than modern students. It was a race to attempt to beat the West technologically. In turn, the West also made their students study harder and learn more, thusly making the average IQ greatly superior than it had been for many years. Well, this is bull. And this is all the kind of stories they try to come up with to explain why IQ is what it is. You know, it comes purely from race. And the lessening of the lowering of IQs comes purely from race mixing with the lower IQ people. And that's why it started around 1960. In everything I've looked at, is that, you know, they want to say, well, it's every kind of reason, cultural reasons. Children, their diet wasn't good enough. They lived in poorer countries. Their parents were stressed out. They're this, they're that. They didn't get the proper toilet training. Anything and everything. But that's not the reason for any of it. It's all to do with race, which is what the Germans told us when Germany was under an honest regime, the National Socialist regime. They explained all that was explained, and they were right about it. But anyway, IQ has been falling at a rapid rate. The average IQ for 2011 is calculated to be 88.54. This is the lowest IQ rate in years, even though we have much more social media and technology. How is this possible? Well, it is shown that rising birth rates go along with a constant population rise in much of the world. Well, naturally. IQ is the intelligence quotient used to measure the intelligence of every human on the planet. Most people in modern-day society have an average IQ ranging between 89 and 100. If you have an IQ that falls out of that range, you are believed to be below average intelligence. Well, I guess. I can't imagine. Levels are too low. I mean, my IQ is way above 101. I mean, that's I wouldn't, that's just an average person, 101, 101. It's not high. It's just average. And it's not to an intelligent person. It's low, you know. It's you just not able to keep up with a whole lot of things, you know. You're not going to be too curious. You're not going to be too interested, and you're not going to want to delve into anything complex. You're going to sort of just get along. So this, so he says, there are four basic IQ tests. I don't know if this is right or not. I didn't know this, but he says that the four basic IQ tests, it tests the four lobes of your brain. The first test tests the back of the frontal lobe of the brain. The second, and then the fourth test tests the rest of the frontal lobe. Two middle tests test the rear lobe and the occipital, which are supposedly are meant to process information and how well it comprehends it. And the frontal lobe is where your learning takes place. That is what this guy says. He does. He's just a student. So, okay. He says, studies conducted in recent years have shown a direct correlation between population growth and the decline in the standard IQ of countries. And he names a few countries. Well, that, yeah, if you, population growth means you've got more people, and you're going to have, well, it depends on where this population growth is coming from. If they're coming from the outside, if they're coming from a lower IQ people, then it's naturally going to lower your IQ. But anyway, it says for every 10 years, but see, it just shows that, well, here's the important part. For every 10 years, a 0.3 IQ drop occurs. So it is predicted by the year 2050, the average IQ will have fallen to 89.32 from 91.46. Well, above he said that the average IQ was in 2011 was 88.54. Now he seems to be saying something different. It's gonna, by the year 250, it's gonna go to 89. I don't know. It doesn't make sense. Anyway, it says, how is it science points to the process of natural selection? It shows that people will flock to people of similar IQ levels. So thusly, people with lower IQ levels would mate with people of similar standings, thus producing offspring of similar learned standards. Well, we know that. Now, he says he interviewed people around his campus, and he said over half of them said that they believed that the average IQ was actually rising because of the great amounts of technology and that we had access to now. When I explained to them and showed data more often than not, they were astounded with the results. I went on to explain that just because we have newer technology and greater access to knowledge now doesn't mean we really we know how to use it. Over the years, a human's ability to process and use information has definitely fallen. One way I have seen this is how we aren't able to communicate with other people as well as our parents were. Because we have such a large access to social media and texting, we are actually losing one of the greatest forms of human contact we need, and that is the ability to communicate with our fellow man face-to-face. Well, this is made worse with anonymous internet users. People who go around communicating with others on the internet anonymously really lose their ability to communicate intelligently with real people, as a real person. It's not a good thing at all. And, you know, he says that people, what does he know, but he says that people with higher IQs can communicate with people face-to-face very well and express what they're trying to say in an educated manner. Well, of course, that's very true. And it is concluded that with our ever-rising population of the Earth, that the average IQ will undoubtedly continue to fall. I'm moving back to my studio here. It has been proven that people with similar IQ scores are more likely to breed with each other, so their offspring will have a similar IQ. Well, hopefully, you know, we don't, if we have lower IQs breeding with higher IQs, yeah, it might I don't know that it helps anything considering how IQ goes back to the norm or whatever they call it, but it's only going to bring down the IQ of the higher in the offspring of these pairs. So the eugenic program undertaken by the Germans under Adolf Hitler was so important, so necessary, so positive and so good, which now in our stupid, amongst our stupid people and leaders is attacked as evil and harmful. And then we've got that stupid President Hollande of France, who I said on Saturday, he had just recently come out and said that his whole reason to be, his whole reason for living was to help the poorest and the most, really the lowest of the people, that the least capable people were what he cared the most about. That is so absolutely asinine. But that's what the problem is today. That is the problem. And we have to look at this IQ thing. And when we look at it, we see that it affects whites very much, very, very much. And when we look at that map, European map, we see that all Europeans are, as we see this, we think of it in terms of this greater Europe, you know, including even Western Russia and so on, that we're not all equal. And as a matter of fact, we shouldn't be even having children together. Now, people say, well, that doesn't happen very often. Mostly it's the people that, you know, that are more similar. Yes, okay, mostly you're right, because as it was said by Frerichs and Walter Gross, the people naturally are able to keep their integrity throughout the centuries, but it's been breached. It's been breached very badly, as we see already with the lowered IQs and so on. So we cannot take it that all white people are interchangeable. We just can't. It's the same thing, as I've said this before, it's the same thing as amongst those who are anti-racist, who say all human beings are the same. And we know that's not true. We make fun of that. But then we accept it amongst all white people. And it's not any more true there than it is amongst all people. So now I've only got 20 minutes left, and I do invite a caller if someone wants to call in. I'm watching this here. I'm not looking at my email, so I probably don't have anything there. Maybe I'll just real quickly close this down and go there, just for the heck of it. But probably nothing. There's probably nothing there, but I'll look. Well, I got a bunch of emails, but I've been getting a lot of spam. Boy, have I been getting the spam lately. No, nothing on the program. If anybody wants to call, and I'm going to turn now. This concludes my all that I can say tonight on this, and I'm not even going to try to sum up or say what my point is. I hope it's clear. It's just, I suppose, my own strong personal feelings about it more than anything, and so I've given those. Now, what I'm going to end with is a more controversial type of stuff, but which I, you know, I really had to think hard whether to even say anything about this, because I'm only doing it because of a program I listened to this afternoon, and what I heard on there caused me to say, you know, I think I should bring this up if I have time. Well, I have time, so I'm going to do it. And it's going to be talking about people sort of in our movement in a, who, but not important people, but, you know, think basically attacks made or lies. And well, basically it's about lies. All right. A couple weeks ago, I got an email from a woman. I don't even remember her name, and she says, "Oh, Jack Maloney has said some things about you, and I questioned him about it. Some bad things about you. I questioned him, and he said, well, he didn't have anything against you, but he hated the white network and blah blah. And but you should check that out or whatever." I don't know if I checked it out right away, but eventually I saw, it wasn't too long ago because I didn't do it right away, but I saw the other day, for some reason, I went to his website, European Nights Project, because I think it was because I discovered that he had now had a radio program with Rodney Martin's American Nationalist channel, and he's been, you know, built up real big, and he did. Rodney had him on his show. I didn't listen to that, but I listened to Jack, and he also calls himself Giacomo Vallone, V-A-L-L-O-N-E. He had Rodney on his first program, so. I was looking there and I saw this thing about me, and this is what he wrote on and not very long ago. Actually, he was writing about white nationalists and writing about John DeNugent, speaking of John DeNugent in a very friendly way, seemed to me. And then he was writing about South Africa. Yeah, South Africa and white nationalists. And he is very anti-white nationalist, this guy. And I really don't want to, you know, advertise him. So I'm not saying too much about him. But he wrote, South African genocide is being exploited by white American nationalists. So that's what he's saying. South African genocide is being exploited by white American nationalists. These vile men, vile, are now exploiting what's transpiring in South Africa for their own gain, as evidenced by the numerous South African genocide groups run by people who have never even met anyone from South Africa. But, you know, he's blowing smoke here, just blowing smoke, because he has tried to make himself into the great champion of the white South Africans, because... And he admitted, I remember back when, he said that he had just written an article on his website about South Africa. And then he said, oh, he got 1,000 hits on it right away. And so I thought, boy, you know, it brought a lot of people to the website. So then he started writing about South Africa. And he supposed, you know, people thought he was some kind of a South African expert or great friend of South Africa. And he's playing that up here. And he says they use, the white nationalists, he's saying, use the ethnic cleansing campaigns perpetrated against the white Afrikaner, Boer and Anglo people to further their own gain and hinder our efforts in the process. Who's hindering? Nobody's hindering his efforts. He says, now listen, he says, not one of these individuals has done a thing to assist white South Africans, having neither donated money to our movement and poor, his movement and the poor. He's saying these, none of these white nationalists who are talking about South Africa have done anything positive for him. He doesn't know, but that's what he's saying, or acted to see their governments change their policies toward white South Africans in any way, shape, or form. Well, that's that part, but then it goes on and says, surprisingly, in fact, when I spoke to Carolyn Yeager, a well-respected American white nationalist, about our plight, you know, what's our plight? Our plight is the genocide of white South Africans. That's what he's talking about. She told me she could, quote, care a less, unquote. This man can't write worth a darn, just like Rodney Martin, and only talked about it because, quote, that is what people wanted to hear, unquote. Each time I attempted to discuss the genocidal conditions in South Africa, she wanted to speak about, quote, Jews and Adolf Hitler, unquote. Now, let me put this in a way that where this comes from. It probably was in April or May that I invited this person on this Giacomo Fellone to be a guest on my program. I wanted to hear what he had to say about his idea about Europe and European, why he was so much against white nationalism and why he thought he was an expert on European nationalism and so on. And he's very strange, his responses. Oh, yeah. And then it was real hard to get together with him. He's I was trying to get his Skype ID, that's what it was, and he didn't want to give it to me. He wanted me to give him mine. And I says, well, you give me yours, and then I'll contact you. But he never did it. But finally, shortly before we were going to do the program, a couple days or so, he finally sent it to me. And so I just took a chance and called him. And I thought I wanted to talk to him and find out just what he sounded like and what he had to say about all this. And we ended up talking for an hour. And he recorded that call without asking me or telling me that I was being recorded. But I didn't have anything to worry about it. I mean, I didn't say anything wrong. But after talking with him for a while, I found him to be not to have the beliefs that he expresses in some places on his website, that, you know, he says different things, but he really wasn't. He said he's a total national socialist, but in talking to him, he got further and further away from that. And finally, he was putting down national socialism and attacking, I wouldn't say attacking, but really highly criticizing Adolf Hitler, and not for that at all, and just changing his position all around, which is representative of his basic dishonesty. You know, he says a lot of things that are okay, that I even agree with, and that I'm sure he believes, and he's but he's got some kind of a, there's, he's got this tendency to make things up. And so I finally said to him, and I thought I'd be just right up front with him while we were talking, and I said, you know, I have to tell you, I've changed my mind about having you come on my program, because these things that you're telling me now, I don't go along with, and I don't want to have it on my program. And then he got real upset, and you know, and started and accused me, and said he. Then he told me that he was gonna write an article about post it about what I had said to him and how I had promised him to be on the program, and then said I wouldn't let him do it. And then he said he was recording our conversation. I said how you know, and he's gonna quote me and everything. So, you know, I don't know. I eventually said, you know, I'm just finished with this discussion. And I hung up, and he tried to call me back, and I didn't answer. And then he wrote to me after that, you know, threatening me and so on. But now he never did do what he threatened to do. And I said, you know, it works both ways. You know, if you want to write about me, I can write about you too. And so he didn't do it, but now he's did have something negative about me, but he said he was going to write it on his site, but he never did, as far as I know. But now there's this little thing. And after saying this, and I want to say, I need to say that what he says here, you know, I don't recognize myself as saying these things. This was not me, but I probably might have said these words somewhere, like care less. That's the only thing that's in quotes, care less. And in quotes is because that's what people wanted to hear. So he's the kind of person that would, and he has done it. He has taken, I guess, possibly a few words that I said and out of context, and not only out of context, but put them into having a different meaning that they had all together, because when he says, I only talked about it, here's another one, quote, because that's what people wanted to hear. I never talked about the white South Africans. I never talk about South Africa. I leave that to other people. I don't know anything about it. I know what, you know, what everybody knows, but I never got real interested in it. So I just, I leave it alone. So for him, except in that one program I talked about in connection with those English down there, the English, the World War One issues. But you know, none of this has anything to do with me, but he's putting it on me. And then he goes on to say, when asked why a so-called white nationalist didn't care about the only true white genocide on the planet, she laughed. Yes, laughed. Huh. Well, I'm laughing right now, so I might have laughed like that, because if he makes claims like that, I don't know, you know, what to think about him. I don't know. But anyway, you know, this doesn't mean anything what he's writing here. But he's trying to make it, and this is so low down. And then he says the same holds true for people that run the White Voice, White Network, and other organizations that have literally used our plight to further their racist anti-American gains. Well, as far as I know, the White Network never talked about white South Africa. Really, he just has a hatred for certain people. And I think he hates Tan Staffel, because Tan Staffel went after his website and him, but at me too at the same time. And then he says, What have they latched onto this? Why have they latched onto the situation in South Africa? He's going on and on, like he owns South Africa, and all these white nationalists are trying to use it. Still the same theme here. And his answer is to exploit our unique life-threatening situation and spread the nonsensical notion that their governments, whatever that is, somewhat anti-white policies compared to the genocidal conditions we live in. And he signs his name, Giacomo Valloni. Well, the reason that now that what I listened to today that's so interesting is that I listened to his second program on ANA, whatever his program's name is, and he said at the beginning a very unbelievable statement, and then I wouldn't have thought so much of it, but he repeated it again at the end, and with the assurance that it was absolutely true. And what he said was that his website was getting a couple hundred thousand visits every day. A couple hundred thousand visits, and he repeated it, and there's no mistake in that. He says he's beating David Duke and becoming the number one site of his type, and he's just plain lying. You know, he's just plain lying. I'm moving toward the third anniversary of my present website, and I am moving toward 400,000. I don't think I'll make that visits all together. I don't think I'll make that by September 27th. But I'm on my way to that. And so that's the 200,000 visits a day that he says he gets took me 3 years. I mean, 1.5 years to get there. Over a year to get there. Well, now I get more than I did the first year, but let's say a year. And he gets in 1 day. Come on. Come on. How can this man lie like this? And I looked his site up on Alexa, and Alexa's got a lot of problems, and you can't follow, but generally you get the general idea. And his global rank is at 532,774. Mine is currently a little over 200,000. So, but there's no individual country rank for him. He's got a high bounce rate, which is not good. His page views per visit is 1. His daily time on the site is 2 minutes and 13 seconds. There's nothing on the map. Search visits, 0. Sites linking into his, only 61, which is quite low. And he says he's beating David Duke. David Duke's global rank is at 156.047. And, boy, David Duke is not doing very well. He's 90,000 in the U.S. I'm 50,000. So anyway, I've got to close for now so I can close the show on time. And this just tells me, I'm bringing this up because it's an example of outrageous lying that goes on amongst people who supposedly, you know, are respectable and are people think, you know, they can follow them and so on. And, okay. Well, ladies and gentlemen, I want to thank you for listening to me tonight. And this has been Carolyn Yeager on the Heretics Hour on September 8th, 2014. Good night.